Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for another episode of Health Talks with Dr. Trin, the one show. Heck, maybe the only show that shows you how to live a healthier life. And those who are tackling all the issues from physical health to mental health. Today, we're going to have a healthy discussion about veterans, from a couple of veterans themselves. Veterans of many wars, personal and foreign here. Welcome with the man who's never at war, Dr. Trin. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm never at war.
Always peaceful. It's that Zen Buddhism. It's whatever here. Yeah.
Peace is my middle name, I'm sure. Gary and Steve here. I'm very peaceful towards them, at least online.
So who'd you bring with you today? We had a conversation that blew my mind with your guest here. Literally, I've told more people, and I don't even know how to explain the conversation, except I felt like I met Orange County's Elon Musk. That's all I can tell you. When we talked to Steve Wilburn last week, he's casually telling us how he's going to, build dock in a boxes and take him to Africa and other places around the world. Oh, and by the way, he's going to power him some way that nobody's ever thought of. And he's also taking trash and methane and turning that into an alternative fuel. You know, just the normal everyday kind of stuff we all think about when we get up in the morning here.
Yes. Yeah, it's amazing. Steve is definitely Elon.
He didn't deny it either. He took that compliment rather easily there. He didn't push back. Yeah.
If Steve is Elon Musk, then Jerry Husan, I would say, is
Mahatma Gandhi.
Mahatma Gandhi. Wow, we got a couple of big heavyweights here with us today. Elon Musk talks about it.
Oh, my word. By the way, Paul?
Yes.
On the Facebook Live, I think we're all dark.
Oh, we are. We are. Look at it again, because it should be. All right, well, we'll get it all while we're talking. So introduce. So last week's discussion led to today's discussion.
Last week's discussion, we have learned that Steve was a Vietnam War and is a Vietnam War veteran. And we had a snippet, just a short snippet of his story. And we felt it was really important to hear his story today.
Well, particularly because he's one of those men of a certain age who went through that era, that life-defining war, as most wars are for their generation. And he went back and tried to make peace with what he had, what that all meant, and what his role and the people he fought and all this stuff here. So that's what led to this discussion about that kind of going back and squaring the circle.
And he came back with Jerry Husan, from executive director from 7 Day Hero, awesome friend of ours, and who takes veterans back to Vietnam.
Yeah. So let's start with Jerry and just explain to us who you are, because we talked to Steve last week, who you are and why you founded this organization. Then let's get into, why does this organization even need to exist? What do you do?
Wow. Well, we founded 7 Day Hero in 2010, and we had seen a need in Vietnam. I'd been there a couple times and saw that we could make a difference. So I started a nonprofit that would do some humanitarian work. And along the way, I met some Vietnam vets, and I'm a Vietnam-era vet that was headed to Vietnam, and they switched my orders and sent me to Europe instead.
Wow.
So I saw it from afar and visited there a couple times, saw the needs, and met some Vietnam vets and just casually asked, you guys want to go back? And because it's different now.
Yeah.
75% of those living in Vietnam know nothing of the American War, which is what they call it.
Yeah.
And we were just an asterisk to them because they fought the Chinese, the Japanese themselves, the French. And so we're an asterisk. But to us, Vietnam is not an asterisk.
No. And it hasn't left our consciousness. It may be fading. It may soon turn into World War II or World War I, a forgotten memory from a forgotten generation. But for now, it ain't forgotten. As Steve says, it's good to be noticed anytime. We're still noticed. We're still making noise here, the baby boomers. I was just a few years behind you guys and was facing the prospect of going or of being drafted. And of course, did what every good suburban kid did. I went to college, and that deferred it long enough so I never had to go. But I always wonder, would I have gone? I guess I would have. And what that would have done to me personally, I can't imagine, having heard the stories of older siblings, brother. I didn't have an older family member, but all my brothers or my buddies, my tribe in high school all had older brothers who went. And boy, most of them came back pretty messed up, or they either didn't want to talk about it at all ever again, or it forever changed their lives in not good ways.
No, for sure. And you know, the guys that did go, courageous.
Yeah.
Just unbelievably courageous. They maybe didn't know what they're getting themselves into. But then we took some vets back, and Steve is one of those. And the courage that it takes to go back and kind of deal with your past is unbelievable. And it had some great effects on some guys that we've taken. And Steve was part of a special group in that I handpicked three Vietnam vets who went back and came face to face with their former enemy.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
So, Steve, what was that? Tell us, let's take us back in time a day. You may have a year or two and a couple of us here. You went to Vietnam when and why? Was it patriotism? Were you already in the service? What was it, just you got drafted? What? Explain to us, remind us, take us back to those days. What was it like, and when did you go?
I was raised in a family of patriots. All my uncles, everyone I admired, had served in World War II, some of them with bravery, distinction. They're all served with bravery. Some were honored for that bravery and recognized for it. So I grew up emulating them. I wanted to be them, and they were patriots. They didn't talk about the war experience themselves. They were very quiet in that regard. But what they did in their action spoke volumes. They suited up as young men, and they showed up, and they fought for the duration of that war. It wasn't a 1 year or a 2 year enlistment or a 2 year or a 1 year commitment.
These weren't summer soldiers, as they used to call them in the revolutionary days, that served for a few weeks or a few months and then went home.
They weren't conscription. They were basically all in, and the nation needed them. They suited up and they showed up. When they came back, they picked up their lives and they went on, and they suffered in silence for the most part.
So when did you go, and why did you go to the Marines? Oh my God, you're going to go to the most extreme unit possible here. Let's not go to the Seabees or something here. Yeah.
Well, no, that wasn't my nature or my intention. At 17, at 16, I was dating a girl, and this is part of the story that shows you that generation. It's actually when the Gulf of Tonkin was attacked, which was one of the precursors of the war. Mr. Kelly, I was dating his daughter, Paulette, threw a newspaper across the table at me and said, "What are you going to do about this?"
About this, like you can do anything about this, but you, suddenly this was a personal thing. And that was a controversial, you know, historians are still trying to remember the Gulf of Tonkin. Remind us a little bit, that was in LBJ's days, or was that the LBJ's days? Yeah.
And, yes, it was.
And not exactly sure how much of that really was, I don't know. Was it real?
The non sequitur, whether it's a contrived event or whatever it was a precursor to war.
Yeah.
The intention was to go to war.
Right.
And whatever pretext they use, that's above my pay grade. But the point was the notion that it was a personal responsibility. What was I going to do? Not what the nation's going to do, not what the world was going to do, what I was going to do about this.
Yeah.
Okay. And I took that to mean that, and based on the other history I gave you, at the age of 17, I lied about my age. I graduated high school at 16, and I was a gifted student. Anyway, the point is that I did lie about my age. I wanted to serve. At that time, there was not the sophisticated background checks and, you know, all the
databases. Come on in. Yeah, now, right.
They just took my name, signature, and I went in the Marine Corps.
So you came in with high aspirations. America needs me. We're under attack. This is World War II or Korea all over again. It's my time to serve like others before me have.
Right.
Tell me about that service. What was it like? Where did you end up and how long were you there? And what year was this? I forgot when the Gulf of Tonkin
was. It was 1967. I enlisted in 66, the end of 66, and was in Vietnam in 1967, which was one of the heaviest casualty periods of the war, 67 and early 68.
So
we were losing 200 plus kids killed in action every week.
Wow.
So I went through advanced training in Okinawa. I won't bore you with all the details.
Right.
Okinawa, I learned how to really effectively conceal myself, do some missions that would be later beneficial to my unit and to the team, but it was advanced jungle warfare training. After I completed that, I hopped on a plane and landed in Da Nang. And from Da Nang, I was assigned to the 3rd Marine Division, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marine Regiment, and spent the duration of my tour with that unit.
Would it be safe to say that that was a war unlike any other? And I'll give you some examples. You know, when my father fought in World War II, it took a while to get there and it took a while to come back. So there was a sort of anticipation getting there and a decompression coming back. In Vietnam, when people came out, or even when they came out of the jungle, suddenly, you know, 10 minutes later, they're back in, I don't know, the Philippines or something here. I mean, you know, it was it was like our living room war. We went in and out of it. Well, suddenly we're in the midst of combat and horrible circumstances. And all of a sudden you're just back home on the base or off or back in San Francisco or whatever. It was, the time was all compressed. And I think that was part of what was so surreal about it.
We had a saying, it was going back to the world.
Yeah.
This was an alien environment for us. So the Vietnam vets call it going back to the world. What's happening in the world? What was happening in the world was anything that wasn't happening where we were at.
Yeah.
Because no one could rationalize that. You can't get to a point where, at least I couldn't get to the point where that was reality. It was to us a more of a suspended animation, if you will.
So I'll tell you one story, the only story that I've ever heard about the Vietnam War that stuck with me. Again, I wasn't there, but I was sort of like next in line to go. And many years later, I met a guy, friend of my wife's friend. He was married, he was a few years older, and he had been in there since the beginning. I think he got there earlier, 65, 66, when there were still advisors being sent in by Kennedy. And he became a Green Beret. He was one of the original batch of Green Berets. So he was always off in country doing something surreal or mysterious or whatever. And one of the things he had to do, as he describes it, was to go capture somebody. That was one of the ways they got information, is go get me a Vietnamese soldier and let's interrogate him, which means he had to go wander the jungle until he wait and capture somebody and drag him back. And then they do whatever they did to get information out of people. So he literally had a Vietnamese, he told me it was a colonel, but maybe he's exaggerating, that he captured in one of these raids, and he's carrying the guy back on his back, just he and this colonel that he beat up and knocked out to capture him. And he realized at some point he was lost in the jungle, and he's wandering for literally a day or two, and he's running out of food and he's running out of everything. And he's got this unconscious Vietnamese on his back. And at some point he realizes the Vietnamese colonel is dead. And so here he is wandering through the jungle, trying to bring back this interrogation prisoner. He's lost. He thinks he's dying. His prisoner has died. And he said, I started to take out my pistol to shoot myself, because I couldn't take it. And at that moment, a helicopter flew overhead, saw me, picked me up, handed me a cold Budweiser. And within a short period of time, I'm back at the base like nothing ever happened. He said, that's how surreal it was.
Yeah, there's a million guys with a million stories.
Exactly.
It's typical. Typical. Your friend's story is typical.
So how did it affect you? Was it what you anticipated? It never is. What's the sum? How do you sum up that experience to people who weren't there?
Well, when you're just turned 18, you have no concept of death, basically, or at least I did. Death happened to old people.
Yeah.
Or it happened, horrific car accident or something like that. It wasn't something that entered in your mind. But the second day that I was in country, I saw horrific slaughter, and I saw people dying to the left of me, to the right of me, all around me, and especially in front of me. And to see that type of horrific destruction of human body parts flying around the air, it had an impact on me. All of a sudden, I realized that I could die.
Yeah.
Something pretty serious. This is not a game. This is not Okinawa war jungle training. This is actually happening.
Right.
It's happening in real time. And it happened almost on a continuous basis for me.
So how did the other thing about the Vietnam War is, even for, again, I wasn't there, so correct me if I'm wrong, but the impression we all have is sort of like Apocalypse Now. Even those who went couldn't understand at some point, what are we doing? Why are we there? And just trying to survive and, you know, protect your buddies was the mission at some point.
Politics weren't really front and center in my mind, or I think most of the vets' mind at that time. Yes, there were protests. Yes, there were starting to be the anti-war sentiment was starting to grow even in 67. You remember the convention came up in 68,
the right.
rebellion right. against the war. But
the Democratic Convention, yes, right. That sort of put it on front and center on the news there. And vets yeah. started coming back like John Kerry and others and saying, take your medal. I don't know what we did. I don't know why we're there.
Well, John Kerry and, you know, well, that's a whole, don't yeah. talk to me about that.
Yeah, right? I'm sure. I'm sure it's a very
good. It's been a pleasant conversation so far.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about that SOB.
But it in a way that my father could never understand how any veteran could ever, right or wrong, it was your service, it was your country, and you went and did this. Right or wrong, it wasn't for you to say. You just were called and you answered the call. And suddenly people questioned the call. Suddenly,
I don't care what people thought. I really didn't. It didn't bother me. As I said, I lived for the guy to my left, to my right, and what we say our six. Our six is the rear of you.
Right.
You look at a clock, 12 o'clock, 3,
oh,
6.
Okay.
Right. The sixth position, you're very vulnerable. So whoever was on your six, you trusted with your life.
Literally.
And that's the way it was. We just trusted each other.
I knew another guy years ago who I did some work with who was older than I was, who was a pilot, fighter pilot. And one of the things he took away for his whole life, I think this is true of a lot of fighter pilots, I had a habit to show up late to a meeting. And one day he took me aside and chewed me out. He said, son, he said, you don't know what I went through. He said, when I showed up late, somebody died. And he said, that's the way I approach late. You take it so frivolously here. When I say I'm going to be there at 8, that means I'm late if I'm not there at 5 minutes to 8. You know, that kind of training and discipline, what does that do to you for the rest of your life?
For me, it turned into a positive because what are you going to do to me? You're going to send me 12,000 miles away from my home? Right.
What's the worst
thing? You're going to put hot metal in my body against my will? Well, you know, come on. It puts it in perspective. So whatever challenges that faced me, the Marines have that saying, we jokingly were talking about it before going live here, adapt, improvise, and overcome, improvise, adapt, and overcome.
Right.
And I've used that successfully in my life since Vietnam. You know, 9 months in the hospital after when I was wounded for the last time, I was medevaced out. You talked earlier about what was it like to transition.
Right.
I was on the battlefield with three of us. Three friends, there were four of us, and we were slaughtered pretty much over a 2-day period. We were trapped and eventually overcome. And I was able to drag one of my buddies away with me until I passed out. They found me a day later. I was declared dead, killed in action. My parents were notified by telegram. My mother and my father received a telegram, and then they had a knock on the door from the Marine recruiter that said, your son was killed in action. And at that time, what was really happening was that I was medevaced out by one of those brave pilots you mentioned in helicopter. I was helicoptered back to Da Nang. From Da Nang, I was lucky. God intervened in this whole chain of things in my severe wounds. They took me, stabilized me, put me on a plane to Yokosuka, Japan, which was a major medical hospital that treated very severely wounded vets. They stabilized me again. I got on a plane to Alaska, and I went from Alaska to Scott Air Force Base. This all happened in the space of 2 days.
In 2 days, you went from combat with being in a slaughter, as you said,
right,
to suddenly back home somewhere. Yeah.
Naked between two sheets. And when I say back home, it's literal. When I got to Scott Air Force Base in Illinois, I was within a stone's throw of my home. So they give you a phone call. You know, the Red Cross comes in.
Right.
I was pretty much screwed up, IVs and everything else, but they gave me a phone. And they said, you can call anywhere in the United States. And I said, hell, I can stick my head out the window and yell. The farm is right down the road. So when I called, my brother Gary got on the phone. I'll fast forward this. And I said, Gary, it's Steven. I'm home. The phone clicks down.
Yeah.
And I call back. Gary, this is Steven. Quit calling, he said. Click. So I called back and I said, Steven, this is Gary. I'm the oldest. Steven, Sally, Michael, David, Gary, Keith, Janet, Sandy, and Robin. I have 9 kids in our family. And then he drops the phone and screams. And my mom got on the phone. Where are you at? I said, I'm at Scott Air Force Base. I didn't know this story that they were notified that I was killed in action. Anyway, that's how I came home. I mean, it was literally from being near death and dying and trying to help my buddies survive to where now I am going to embrace my mother who thought I was already dead. I don't know how surreal that is, but that was my experience.
You're making the hair in the back of my neck stand up here. What do you think when you hear this, Dr. Trin? I mean, this is a story. You were a Marine. When did you go into the service? When and where? I've never asked you this question. When did you go in and why?
Why? I was probably drunk when I signed up.
Well, that's a common story, right?
Recruiter. I was around during the first Gulf War.
Right.
Was when I was around.
But your parents were immigrants to this country, right?
You came? Yes, we were immigrants. We were rescued on a Chinook helicopter a day before the end of the war. And
so you're one of those that those images of people being taken out, that last flight out. Literally people, I don't know if this is your case, but people hanging from the bottom of the helicopters, please don't leave us here. And as America finally said enough.
I was a 5-year-old kid during that time and remember the event very clearly.
So why go fight? You must have seen it from a different perspective. How do your parents remember and view the American war?
Yeah, well, we were from the South,
right?
And we were essentially just escaping communism.
Right.
So we were appreciative of, you know, of our opportunity to escape from that war. And we would not be here if it were not for veterans like Steve. We're forever grateful for our veterans. Otherwise, I would not be around.
So we'll bring it back to Jerry. You've heard these stories a million times. I just wanted to paint some picture for those too young to remember what it was like in those days, the craziness, the confusion, the surrealness of it all, the doubts, concerns, the questions. This was not a time when veterans came back and people said, oh, thank you for your service. Instead, they spit on you, right?
But yeah, and they and then the veterans just stuffed it down
exactly.
And wouldn't talk about it. People were afraid to ask, and they just tried to go on with their lives when something so impactful as combat, as being in a war zone, as seeing their friends die, impacts you emotionally, psychologically for their whole lives. And so I've been in vet groups talking to Vietnam vets, and some of those guys are so shaped by the 365 days they spent in Vietnam, and it has shaped them for the last 50 plus years.
Exactly. So such a brutal conflict. If any of the movies are to be believed, from John Wayne's The Green Berets up through Apocalypse Now and We Were Soldiers, and I could rattle off 100 movies that kind of paint this as a brutal, surreal nightmare for so many on all sides here. What that nightmare continues for so many to this day. Why go back? Why relive it? Why face it again? Anybody? Why go back?
Well, I can say for myself, I didn't want to go back. I didn't want any part of Vietnam. Hated Vietnamese. I hated Vietnam.
Yeah.
Until Jerry Houston, I suffered from PTSD, they call it, whatever you want to call it. I had a traumatic brain injury. I had a lot of serious wounds, but basically I, to this day, get nightmares and horrific dreams that seem real. So I was a violent person. Right now, you see, we joke a lot in the last show, and you see someone who's open and communicative.
Yeah.
But Jerry hit the nail on the head. I was very silent. I was very withdrawn. I got in a lot of physical confrontations with people. Alcohol is part of it. But somehow I also had a career doing that. But anyway, let's go back to why I went back. My wife, who passed away from cancer, we had 5 years with her. She taught me how to live life, did the best she could to comfort me, brought me to Christ, Jesus Christ, my faith. And I had not had that till then. And in the course of going to men's group, which is my support, I met Jerry. And Jerry was a good athlete. We talked baseball. We didn't talk the war. We talked guy stuff.
Yeah.
And then he surreptitiously told me what he did.
Worked his way in, yeah.
7-day hero. No, he was straight up. But I fought it for a while, but decided to go. And it's the best decision I've ever made in my life, to be honest with you.
Talk us about that, Jerry. I remember vividly having grown up watching those ahead of me go off and come back with the same anger and pent up and don't want to talk about it and all the problems that came about for so many. They buried it and whatnot. And then Vietnam opened up to us, which seemed inconceivable. This was like, what, the 90s or something when Vietnam, we reestablished diplomatic relations and there was starting to be talk of going back. And most vets I knew hated Vietnam and the Vietnamese. I'm sorry to say, Dr. Trinh, they hated everything about it. That's the last thing they're going to do is go back and face any of this. And so other high profile ones started the trend. It seems like John McCain being one of the most brutal experiences, you know, trapped as a POW, an admiral's son, you know, given the full treatment for all those reasons here. And because he's an admiral's son, refusing to leave until all could leave. And he went back, right? And some others started to go back. What prompted this? Was it just a way to try and end that pain of 30 years?
Well, you know, as I observed, guys, and Dr. Iggy and I went back to Hanoi, and then we went to the Hanoi Hilton.
Yeah.
And we saw McCain's flight suit. They've got it hanging up there. And I'd read so many books on that, and I just kind of absorbed it all. And I had met so many vets that were hurting. They covered up with trying to be real men.
Right.
But
drowning in an alcohol or burying it so deep, yeah. Nobody would ever talk about it. Yeah, right.
And I just went, okay, I can't just let this pass. Something has to be done here. And my wife at the time was a clinical psychologist and helped me understand a few things. And so we felt like if we went back and confronted them, and I had a couple of clinical psychologists go with us just to kind of calm things down if necessary.
Yeah.
Just to give guys the opportunity to see that Vietnam has changed. They have changed and that they can go on with their lives and they don't have to stop it anymore. We sat there and let guys tell their stories. And that's like the biggest thing, to let guys tell their stories, because when they came back, nobody was interested. Nobody wanted to hear it. And no. It was terrifying for the guy telling it and terrifying for the people to hear it.
Right.
So we gave them the opportunities to tell their stories. And as brutal as it was, it's healing when you do that.
Yes, I can imagine, because I think that's a big part of, again, I never served, but for my father's generation, the World War II generation, the good war, the one that we all, you know, celebrate and remember when that set the tone for how we were going to approach, we were going to save the world and fight the good fight for everybody here forever. And he didn't talk about it for a long time. He had nightmares, all this stuff. I mean, the experience is war, war is hell. As some general said, Lee or Ulysses Grant or somebody said that. And yet they, at some point, people wanted to hear those stories. They still, for example, my father passed away a number of years ago. I still try and remember he was a bomber pilot in World War II. I grew up hearing those stories and idolizing my friends, and I couldn't wait the few times he'd share any of those stories. We didn't have that same experience with the older brothers and stuff who came back from Vietnam. It wasn't like, oh, tell us again about Da Nang and all these other horrible battles that were out there. We didn't want to, they didn't want to talk about it. And nobody wanted to hear about it. There was no celebrate. It's Vietnam Day. Like there are at these air bases and naval bases stuff where come on out, we're going to celebrate World War II and remember all that they did. There was no remembrance and retelling of those tales over and over again. I think that's part of the problem.
You know, it was so brutal and such a nightmare for guys that it affects them 50 years later, 60 yeah. years later. And you know, I've met some Vietnam vets who live in Southern California that will drive down the 405. They were so brutalized in their Vietnamese or the Vietnam conflict and in the war there that they can't even drive off into Little Saigon.
Wow.
They can't, like Westminster
yeah,
or
right.
Bolsa.
Off the 22 there. Yeah. Yeah, right.
They can't go there. They can't even drive. And I took, and she was the part of this, I took about 30 guys and we walked in the Tet Parade in Garden Grove about 3 years ago, Steve, or so, maybe four.
Yeah, I think probably four or five. Yeah.
Yeah. And And I knew, because I knew, I've been to Vietnam 27 times, and I know the Vietnamese, and I knew that they would celebrate those guys that freed them from communism and paved the way for them to come to America. And I knew that that would happen. But these guys are like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen. Of course. But they came. People gave them a standing ovation. They ran out and hugged the guys in this big, huge parade. And guys were overwhelmed because and thankful that somebody cared. And they made a difference. Little Saigon exists today because of Vietnam vets like Steve Woodburn.
And think about how surreal that is. So the one place you don't expect to get a warm reaction is the one place you do. The country that you fought for and died for doesn't want to hear about it, divided over this was a good thing or a bad thing. Get on with it. We're not going to talk about it. We're not going to honor it. We're not going to remember it. And the one place in Dr. Trinh's world that, because these were our allies that fought with us, that we were there fighting for. And yet you would think, again, the vets would just lump everybody together. All Vietnamese are bad here.
No, and the Vietnamese are wonderful, wonderful people.
Agreed.
So.
Especially the ones that like chicken feet.
chicken feet.
Yes.
Yuck. Yuck. You don't eat a chicken's foot. There's nothing there to eat.
Steve,
delectable. Delightful.
There you go. Steve, what was your trip back to Vietnam like? Being able to just, you know, see the eye surgeries and the leprosy centers and the orphans and all that. What was that like for you going back?
I think without that, the way that Jerry and the team and you guys organized that to take me into a situation that we knew was going to be uncomfortable, all of us.
Yeah.
And when I went to see the eye surgeries being performed and the leper colony and the orphanages really did it for me, especially the orphanages, to be able to, and there's some wonderful pictures that I have that I look at continuously. They're on my screensaver, actually, of me holding children in the orphanages. And to be, as a father and a grandfather at that time, to be able to see these children, it just blew my mind. I mean, it opened my heart. I looked at the Vietnamese as people then. They weren't the enemy any longer. Almost. I was not quite there until we get to Hanoi. But anyway, you set me up, Jerry and Dr. Trinh, and you did it beautifully because you changed my heart. I could no longer look at them. I had to see them as individuals, not as a generic Vietnamese race or whatever. These were human beings with human lives and stories. And it just set me up for when I was going to go meet the enemy. And you can talk about that, Jerry. How'd you set that up, by the way?
Yeah, talk about that. Cool.
Explain how that happened.
Well, Dr. Trinh, you don't know him very well. He has relatives in high places in North Vietnam, but I'm...
I didn't know that. I didn't know he has connections to the North, to the communist North here. I'm going to think twice about this here. Okay.
He does. And, you know, you need to consider who you bring on your show, just to let you know.
I'm whole new respect. Whole new respect. Okay.
And we knew some people that knew some people, and it took us a couple of years, but we finally got that settled. And they have no problem meeting with us. It was no big deal. But for us, we're like, and we don't know what's going to happen. And so I went into a meeting way before I took Steve and those guys, and met the number two guy in their VA. So they've got the top guys, the four top guys in their VA, all were vets that America. And I met the number two guy, and he comes out, doesn't acknowledge me, and he starts off with
We're losing you a little bit. I'm sorry. So I don't want this is a good story, and I'm going to lose it at this point here. So
okay.
So you met one of the top VA guys who had
number two guy,
and he had fought against the Americans, right?
Yep. And then he wanted, and he didn't even say hi, nothing. He just started reading off what he hates about America.
Wow. He's got to unload too. Like we've got to somehow let it go and unload. He's got to unload. Like, right?
You know, this isn't going very well. Well, then we showed him the humanitarian work that we're doing. So the number of three and four and five guys, they went, oh, okay. You know, okay, we're behind you. And, you know, eventually they said, hey, whatever you do in Vietnam, eye surgeries, orphanages with the lepers, we will help you. If you need help, you let us know because we appreciate what you're doing. And then they've got the Agent Orange building for children, because it's still, it, you know, Agent Orange has a half-life, which means it lasts for 1,000 years. And it's through the water table.
And just remind everybody that Agent Orange was a, I don't know if it was the craziest thing we ever did, or it certainly made military sense at some point, but it was the wildest, most destructive thing. We created this Agent Orange, this defoliant. Because they couldn't see. It's a jungle, most of the country, so much of it. So how do I find the enemy to shoot them, to kill them, to stop them? I got to wipe out the jungle cover. And they thought, well, let's just drop this everywhere, not thinking through what the effect would be on the people below, our people, their people, everybody that got this stuff dropped on them. And it wiped out the jungle and defoliated so they could see people and shoot them.
And it wipes out our VA. Our veterans, because, you know, leukemia and all the different things. And so their Agent Orange Children's Home is right next to the VA in Hanoi. I mean, right next door. And so I provided some funds for that, but I let them know, as they were telling me about this place, I said, our veterans and Americans suffered because of Agent Orange too. So you're not the only ones that are suffering here. Right. And it's going to continue. So anyway, eventually we went to a dinner. And it started off a little rough, and Steve, I don't know if you want to.
All right, Steve's got his pick. He chuckled like a little rough, like that's like saying the airline pilot. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, we're in for a little bit of rough thing as the plane's crashing and going down.
There were some very nice people at the table. The other two veterans who went with me have a different personality than truly, and they were very accommodating. And I was a little standoffish because now I'm sitting with actual Vietnamese combat veterans.
Viet Cong
or the NVA, the North Vietnamese Army.
Yeah, exactly. So as guys do, I was sitting next to one gentleman and we were drinking and having dinner. And thank God there was a little more drinking going on because I started to become more relaxed. But I don't remember exactly who started it, but we started showing wounds. I've got a lot of scars. I look like I fought with Edward Scissorhands if I would take my shirt. We guys are drinking now, and him and I, through an interpreter, we're comparing wounds and talking about being shot. Guy talk, like in the locker room.
Right.
And all of a sudden, he puts back his hair and he shows me this head wound, like that was a superior wound.
Yeah, right. You think yours is bad? Look at mine here. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, mine's bigger than yours or better than yours. Yeah. Guys do that, you know, I heard. So anyway, the point was... when he said that, it just set me off. And I told the interpreter, tell him, I hope I'm the one that effing, I'll use that word because we're on radio, effing shot him.
Great thing to say to your host.
Gary was there. And the interpreter said, oh, you know, she's like, no. I said, no, tell him. Oh, I'm the one that effing shot him.
Yeah.
So he does, she does, and he looks sort of like that. And then he goes, says something in Vietnamese. The interpreter smiles and tells me he's the one that effing shot you. so then I said that my line was, I took a drink and we shared it, and it's captured in great photos. I said, then let's drink one SOB to another.
There you go. One SOB
to another. From that second on, that moment on, him and I bonded and we had a delightful rest of the evening. But it did change me. That one encounter, probably with that gentleman, changed my heart because I could let go of a lot of demons. Let me just real quick. I don't know whether you can see those.
I can't.
These are etchings from the Vietnam War.
Oh, yeah.
These are my high school buddies, then grade school buddies that served with us in Vietnam and were killed. They're on the wall. That's just two of them. But that's the memory I was carrying with me. And the next time I went to the wall, I have a tradition. When I was younger, I used to, there's 11 of them there. I drank 11 shots. Now I drink one shot. But I told him the story about the shot with that guy. And that was ceremoniously, their forgiveness as well.
Yeah.
And it put it into a position for me that there is a healing that can occur. There is a give back that can occur. You can take some order out of the chaos we endured. And for those guys who sacrificed the ultimate, who I loved, and they were my friends, and they were my childhood friends, who were killed, I was able to release that in a different way with one drink one son of a, excuse me,
one son SOB. We could say son of a bitch. You're Dr. Trent.
Okay. Like that well, it was a son of a bitch. And he, before that moment in time, we're still sons of bitches, both of us. Okay. We both did horrific things. That's what I want to be clear. I'm being light on some of these topics.
Yeah, right.
Let me tell you, I take it very seriously. I killed people with my own hands. I did. I killed. This gentleman you're looking at right now is a killer. He's a murderer, okay? However you want to pin it, however you want to justify it, however you want to excuse it.
Or explain it. Yeah, right.
I took human lives, okay? He did too. So when we say one son of a bitch to another, that's what we mean by that. We did things, but we got to overcome. There's some way we got to figure it out. And thank God he has and I have. But when we deal with each other at that level, it's just a communication you can't have anywhere else. Because God, I hope nobody has that experience. But how do you relate only to someone who's been there that has done what we've done, especially to each other? Okay. Hope that helps.
Helps in ways you can't even imagine here. I just got to summarize what Paula puts on the thing here. Forgiveness is possible. Sometimes we think it's impossible.
Yeah.
And forgiveness heals. And what you didn't hear all those years ago, thank you for your service.
Yeah. That's, welcome home.
Welcome home. Yeah, it took a while. So, Jerry, how did they find out more about this organization? Does the work continue as the Vietnam vets age? Is this something that has a shelf life to it, or is 7 Day Hero more than just ending the story and bringing them home after all these years?
Yeah, you know, we continue to work with vets here. Vietnam's been closed because of COVID, and we're waiting for it to open up. And I'm hearing that the gates are starting to open, and we will take vets back because vets talk to other vets and tell them how healing it was for them, and guys want to be released. So if you want to know more about that, you can go to our website, the number 7dayhero.org, and that's our website. We are presently working with migrants who pick strawberries in Orange County. And so we provide a lot of things for them, basic needs for them and their families. We're there cooking lunch every Saturdays. And so now I'm starting to take Iraqi and Afghanistan vets to the fields because it's healing for them because they got the PTSD.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So
this is a symptom of all wars here.
Yeah. So I just have a heart for those guys, being a vet myself. But then I was in the Air Force in Germany playing baseball. So, you know, you slept safer while I was serving our country.
Yeah, right.
But I have a great heart for guys like Steve, and who's my deep, deep friend. And I appreciate those guys. And, you know, just want to make their way, make it better.
Welcome home. Welcome back. Thank you for all that you guys do here, that you did then and that you do now to move us forward and not be hung up in the past forever here. I'd love to hear more about the story, but we've run out of time for today. As usual, I feel like Dr. Trin, I took too much of the show away here, but I wanted to push that narrative through here. Take us out, Dr. Trin. Why do you do the work? Is this part of just the continuing healing and mental health, the release of letting go?
The opportunity to give back from the blessings that we have all been given. And again, Steve, if it were not for Steve, I would not be here. I would be probably in Vietnam in a rice paddy on an ox.
Yeah. Who knows? Who knows?
And right. So I certainly appreciate him and all our veterans. So great sharing moment. And we got to do this some more, guys.
Yeah. I think we've only scratched the surface. I'd love to hear more of these stories.
Just the surface.
And not just about the Vietnam War, but all wars and how we handle what happens afterwards. The healing that has to take place on both sides as we move forward here. Powerful story, guys. Thank you for sharing it. Thank you for what you did. I'm going to say, I'll leave one last observation on my point. I'm the only one in the room who observed all of this through TV. I didn't go serve anywhere here. I didn't struggle to get on a helicopter to get out as a kid. I didn't have that sort of thing. And in a weird way, I feel, I don't know if it's shame is right the word, but just sort of, geez, I mean, you guys have done so much and I did so little. I think somehow it's more than we know how to process too, how to handle this.
You're doing a lot right now, Phil. Please, you're doing a lot right now.
Well,
by this media, by the way you're making it open and the way you interview, you're of service. Thank you so much for what you're doing.
Thank you, because maybe that's my desire to feel like I contributed in some way too.
There you go.
So many else around suffered, and I'm going to get all teary-eyed here, but so many others gave so much and still give so much.
You're helping these guys tell their stories, and that's huge.
That's what I know how to do best. That's my talent and my contribution. Well, thank you. All right. Well, let's not make this the end of the story. Let's come back and tell more stories at some point in time with other people. I welcome you to come back. It's a powerful story that I don't think gets told. I think it sort of got brushed under the carpet and for too long. And it's time to bring these guys home and bring these stories to bear. All right. Thank you so much for joining us today here. Wow. Powerful stuff, guys. Well, there you have it. The unexpected power of stories from the man who's always collecting stories and sharing them with us here in so many ways. Dr. Trin, Health Talks with Dr. Trin. It is healthy to talk right here on Orange County's only talk radio station, OCTalkRadio.net.